Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk on the Samadhi Sutta. This sutta teaches the importance of using Shamatha Vipassana meditation to deepen concentration and the skillful application of concentration. This talk includes Sangha Q&A and discussion and was recorded at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on November 8, 2016. This talk concludes with meta-intentional meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
Tonight's talk is on the Samadhi Sutta, where the Buddha teaches the proper use of concentration and why we actually develop why we actually use meditation to develop concentration. For the 45 years of his teaching career, the Buddha taught only one meditation method. He taught Shamatha Vipassana, tranquility and insight, and he always taught those two together. The reason why that's significant is modern developments have Vipassana movement that kind of separates Shamatha from Vipassana and teaches Shamatha as a preliminary practice to the insight practice. That's fine. I got no argument with it. It's just not what the Buddha taught. And then even during the Buddha's time, and certainly modern developments have all different applications of things that they call meditation, which are really better classified as contemplation. And a really good example of that is the contemplation on the charnel grounds, which is part of the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha gets into a very elaborate explanation of the human body, how the human body functions, how it breaks down. He mentions all the different internal fluids that are part of the human body. And again, it's very detailed. Many people have taken that as instructions that this is something we should meditate on. We should meditate on a dying and decomposing human body. It was never taught that way. The only reason the Buddha taught that in that sutta, and remember that's the great sutta on mindfulness, is to be mindful that we have an impermanent body that's subject to decay. It's no reason to create a meditation. But that's an example of using meditation for contemplation. He even finishes that sutta with saying, whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, be mindful of what you're doing. You know, in order to be mindful of what we're doing as our life unfolds, we need to develop concentration. And that's why, that's the purpose that the Buddha taught meditation, to deepen our concentration. So, samadhi means, usually translated into a well-concentrated mind, and even more accurate, definition would be a non-distracted mind, because that's what we're trying to develop through the Buddha's Dhamma, a mind that is resting in equanimity, no distractions, no disturbances in it. So I'm going to skip the beginning of it because I really just gave the introduction and get right to the sutta. I'll read the first paragraph before the sutta. The Buddha taught Shamatha Vipassana meditation as one factor of the Eightfold Path for the purpose of developing the concentration necessary to support the refined mindfulness of the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path. At its most profound and skillful usefulness, it is concentration developed within the framework of the Eightfold Path that directly brings cessation of all confusion, delusion, and unsatisfactory experiences. This is the Samadhi Sutta. And the Buddha addresses those gathered. Friends, there are four qualities that are developed from concentration. Concentration, when developed and practiced, leads to developing peace and calm here and now. Concentration, when developed and practiced, leads to developing useful knowledge and true vision. When developed and practiced, it leads to developing refined mindfulness and attentiveness. So there's a difference there between mindfulness and attentiveness. It's rather a subtle distinction. But as the Buddha teaches mindfulness, he teaches it in those two applications of the four foundations of mindfulness and then to be mindful of the Eightfold Path. And so now he's talking about the attentiveness is simply to be able to maintain that mindfulness moment by moment as life occurs. We're able to attend to what's occurring in our lives. That's the reason why he uses both of those terms. And the fourth is developing the cessation of craving, aversion, and delusion, the whole point of the Dhamma, of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha asks, how does the development of concentration lead to peace and calm here and now? When properly engaged in Shamatha Vipassana meditation, one is withdrawn from sensuality and unskillful mental qualities. And this is an interesting teaching on the jhanas, something else that is over-exaggerated. They enter and remain in the first jhana, Delight and pleasure born of withdrawal and accompanied by focused thought and insight. Jhana simply means levels of meditative absorption, and the Buddha taught that there's four of those. Every one of these levels, if you pay careful attention, you'll recognize that you have experienced these during your meditation practice. Even that final one of lasting equanimity, maybe you haven't developed that completely, but you at least experienced moments of a calm and peaceful mind free of disturbance, right? Is that true for all of you? You too, Sarah? As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the second jhana, focused thoughts and insights still. Delight and pleasure born of composure and inner assurance arise. We're taking joy out of our meditation practice. And it's important to recognize that, because that helps right effort. It helps us continue with our practice, especially when we don't really feel like meditating, we're too tired or whatever it might be. We remember what a joyful experience it is to sit quietly and develop concentration, and that provides additional motivation and right intention. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the third jhana. Delight and pleasure and the perception of pleasure and pain disappear. So discursive thinking and even discriminating thinking is starting to subside at this point. Equanimity and refined mindfulness increases, and a peaceful mind prevails. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the fourth jhana. Mindful equanimity prevails. Greed and aversion disappear. This is the development of concentration that brings peace and calm here and now. So that relates to that first description of deepening concentration. And how does the development of concentration lead to developing useful knowledge and true vision? As concentration deepens, distractions subside. Even the passing from day to night and night to day is free of disturbance. So that sounds like a very obscure reference. Of course, night is going to follow day and day is going to follow night. But even at its most subtle level, we won't even recognize that. In other words, we'll have the mindful awareness that it's now nighttime or it's now daytime and it's time to do certain things. But the passing of time will have no significant impact on our thinking. It's just another occurrence. And if we can do that at that subtle level, it means that the more grosser occurrences in our life won't grab our attention and become a distraction. We'll be able to maintain that mind of equanimity no matter what's occurring. Is that clear? And is it clear why the Buddha would use a reference like day to night and night to day? Because he's talking about very, very subtle levels that we attain to. Well, maybe it'll be a little more clear as I continue. If not, just please ask. I'll go back that one sentence. Even the passing from day to night and night to day is free of disturbance. The mind is bright and spacious. And so that spaciousness refers to actual space between thoughts. We're not following one thought immediately with the next thought, especially one self-referential thought with another self-referential thought. Our thoughts have relaxed. You remember the Vitakasanthana Sutta? We'll be able to develop the ability to think what to think when we want to think it. And our minds won't be cluttered with this constant monkey mind that most people describe their thinking of. We have gained control of our thinking, and we think what we want to think when we want to think it. And our thoughts are appropriate to what's occurring, rather than being caught up in a thought that is stuck in the past or is directed towards the future. That's another aspect of equanimity. This is the development of concentration that brings useful knowledge and true vision. And how does the development of concentration lead to developing refined mindfulness and attentiveness? As concentration deepens, the impermanence of feelings is understood. As concentration deepens, the impermanence of perceptions is understood. As concentration deepens, the impermanence of thoughts is understood. This is the development of concentration that brings refined mindfulness and attentiveness. Remember the Buddha's very first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, and Kandana listened to that. And he said, all those things that are subject to arising are subject to cessation. He was talking about this. He wasn't talking so much in a physical sense, but an internal sense. He recognized that his thoughts and his feelings were all impermanent. And if our thoughts are all impermanent and our feelings are all impermanent, why define ourselves by those thoughts and feelings? As Lao Tzu said, once you recognize the impermanence of all things, you'll let go of everything. Why hold on to anything that's fleeting? And certainly, why create an identity over anything that's fleeting? This is mine, this is what I am, meaning I'm attached to whatever is attracting me or whatever I'm averse to. That's creating an identity. The concentration that deepens through meditation in the broader framework of the Eightfold Path, allows us to end that clinging. You remember when the Buddha described an awakened human being, he described that in very, very simple terms. Released or unbound, as in released or unbound from clinging. And it's specifically clinging to self-referential views. We need concentration to do that. That's why the method is so important within the broader framework as well. You couldn't substitute... I started with TM many, many years ago, and I'm not knocking TM, but the method of transcendental meditation would not develop the same Dhamma understanding within the Eightfold Path as Shamatha Vipassana meditation would. And how does the development of concentration lead to developing cessation of craving, aversion, and delusion? As concentration deepens, one remains attentive to the arising and passing away of the five clinging aggregates. So the five clinging aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness, is what we use to describe ourselves. We insist that we have a permanent self because of clinging these five disparate elements together. And we've talked about the five clinging aggregates quite a few times. In fact, we covered it on retreat too. I don't want to get into the five clinging aggregates, but if you have a question about that when we go around, please ask it then. They know the impermanence of form, of feelings, of perceptions, of mental fabrications, and of consciousness. This is the development of concentration that brings the cessation of craving, aversion, and delusion. Friends, these are the four qualities that are developed from concentration. Those who understand the three marks of existence, of impermanence, not self-characteristic, and the resulting dukkha, for whom there are no disturbances, free of desire, are at peace. This one has abandoned confusion, delusion, and disappointment, meaning this one has abandoned all the causes of ongoing suffering in the world. That's the end of the sutta. The Samadhi Sutta teaches the proper use of meditation and how the concentration developed through Shamatha Vipassana meditation directly addresses developing understanding of Four Noble Truths, integration of the Eightfold Path, and the cessation of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, the three defilements. So that's the end of the talk. Before we go around the room, is there any questions directly related to the talk? Nope, we're good. Lorna.
Can you just explain you're going into the night and day?
The Buddha's using the most mundane part of living in the world. And he's pointing out that even that can create a disturbance in the mind simply by noticing it. Noticing and having preferences. So some people have a preference to daytime and they really don't like nighttime. Well, if you have that discriminating thought, if you develop that type of conditioning, you are going to have an agitated mind every time the sun goes down, aren't you? And if you're the other way, if you're a night person, if you're really stuck on I only want to be around in nighttime, when the sun comes up, you're agitated. So he's pointing out something that no human being can ever escape. If you have a human body, you're subject to day and night and night to day. But even then, even at the most subtle level, that won't disturb you. And if you can achieve that level of equanimity, then there's nothing out there that can disturb you. And so, are there any other questions? And did I make that clear?
Yes, thank you.
So when I first read it, it's pretty obscure. Why would you even bring this up? But when you put that in the context of what the Buddha is trying to teach and the purpose of developing understanding of Four Noble Truths, then it becomes clear. Well, this isn't... Anything then at that point is significant. Anything that grabs our attention or creates disturbance in our minds. It also points to emptiness. The true meaning of emptiness, as the Buddha taught that, is to empty ourselves of clinging so that we can empty ourselves of any disturbance in our mind. Ram, how's your meditation practice going? And do you have any questions about this?
Don't have any questions about this. The practice is going well. Despite Mara's insistence and banging on my door in the morning when I'm meditating.
Mara is Ram's goose. In the form of a goose.
But it's actually also I'm using it as a callback. Stuff is going on, and I'm aware of it. And whenever I'm off somewhere during meditation,
That's not
like
a malevolent.
The temple bell.
Yeah, that's not a malevolent marrow. That's a benevolent.
Yeah, I think it's.
I think it's both.
It's the warnings.
It's the middle way goose. I'm glad you're here, Matt. Good to see you.
Good to see everybody. Practice is going well. I like this system. There was something that I thought was neat. This one. And how did the development of concentration lead to developing useful knowledge and true vision? As concentration deepens, distractions subside.
Yeah.
Very succinct.
It almost sounds too simple. Like, is that really worth all the effort? But that's really the problem, is our distracted mind. So, yeah.
And you get to think about what you want to think about.
Yep.
Instead of bouncing back and forth, you can just focus the mind. And
Useful knowledge.
Yeah. Not just knowledge. Useful knowledge. And again, within that right, that proper framework.
I like that.
Thank you for pointing that out. Liz, good to see you. How are you tonight?
Good to see you. Good to see everyone. I'm doing well. My meditation practice has been unseated a little bit lately, but I'll get back to it. And I enjoyed tonight's class. That's all I have.
Glad you're here. Sarah, welcome to our Sangha.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions or comments?
I have a lot of intense outer events going on in my life that are just kind of, I see, like, I can either let them pull me down the path of suffering, or I'm like, well, it's kind of, can be sort of like the knocking, you know, like, it's just a support to get back to practice that I let go when I had children, which was, I didn't fully let go of it, but it's been like slowly just, I used to sit every morning, and then I have three kids, and morning starts, the kids are, you know, there is no space, but I see like I have to start to carve it out, otherwise I'm just food for the fire. It's like,
that's right.
Yeah.
Well, that's,
so I'm grateful to finally take a step.
Yeah, good for you, and that's great insight. You know that the disturbance in life can help support getting back to a real useful practice. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But what you're describing, that outer events in your life, are described as the first noble truth. There is dukkha in the world. There's disappointing, stressful experiences, and the Buddha doesn't stop there. Then he has three other truths leading to the fourth truth, which is the path to learn how to live in the world no matter what's occurring. Dukkha is going to continue to occur, but we will develop the quality of mind that no longer reacts to it. We're able to maintain that mind of equanimity, and this sutta points directly to that. And everything that I teach is taught in relation to developing understanding of the Four Noble Truths. It's what we know that the Buddha actually taught, that's preserved in the Pali Canon. And it's a rather simple and direct way of developing that peaceful, calm mind. So I'm glad you're here, and I hope you continue to join us. Drew, good to see you. How are you?
Yeah. Good. Practice is waxes and wanes from day to day, time spent actually meditating. I am focused on it, and it's pleasing. I have a question.
Sure.
In terms of detachment, I have always kind of walked a fine line between detachment and apathy.
Yeah.
I can tell the difference subjectively when I'm detached. I have a pleasant, somewhat of a smile on my face. When I'm apathetic, I have a scowl. The apathy is easier, and I've always I'm not detached, I just don't care. And so I was wondering how you would distinguish between the two, apathy and detachment.
Apathy would be a lack of true refined mindfulness. And I would classify apathy as more of a detached reaction to life than, and I know we might be playing a little bit of semantics. So the lack of clinging or the non-clinging that's developed through the Eightfold Path, I wouldn't even describe it as detachment, because detachment has almost a, maybe that's the difference between detachment and apathy. Detachment almost has a conscious decision to withdraw. And apathy is rooted in aversion. Where non-clinging is simply the application of ceasing to create an identity by attaching ourselves to anything. So it's subtly different than detaching. Probably a better word, and it was in last week's class. Were you here last week for the wisdom? So you might want to listen to that. A better word for what we're developing through the Dhamma is restraint. And what that means is we don't attach ourselves to things. So it's more...
Attention?
It's more of the intention. So right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. Where detachment and apathy is more of a reaction to life rather than a conscious expression of refined mindfulness.
But even is that, between detachment and apathy, there is the awareness. You can be detached, fully aware, but in apathy, you have kind of switched off the awareness.
If you're aware that you're in detachment or apathy, one or the other, you could ask yourself, what's my intention in either one?
Yeah, I would say that an apathetic attitude to life is more of a reaction than anything else. You've kind of had enough, and you said, whatever it is, I don't want anything to do with this. I don't care what happens. Kind of like tonight's election. I'm just kidding. We should care about what's going on tonight. And you could say that non-clinging is detachment. But you need to look at that yourself. What does that really mean? Because we can create for ourselves, the outer appearance of non-clinging, meaning we can divest ourselves of all our properties and go live in a cave somewhere or under a bridge. I'm not attached to anything. I'm completely detached. Well, that can be a forced attitude. You can also live in a palace like the Buddha did at one point and have all the wealth in the world and yet not be clinging to it. So it's more of an attitude and a state of mind that is developed through the Eightfold Path than directed detachment. Sarah, you had a...
Would you maybe say it's the non-clinging is disidentification and the...
That's a perfect word for it. So, yeah.
So like in the apathy, there's still like the identification with one's...
Yeah, I guess you would say apathy is I don't care. Well, there's the identification. And if we want to use detachment, true detachment does not have an I in it. You know, so anything, another good way of finding out if you're truly detached is to tell yourself, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am, whatever that is. And if you're comfortable with that, then you are truly in a non-clinging space, rather than a forced detachment. So I hope that helps.
Thanks.
It's an excellent question too, because it gets to some subtleties of the Dhamma that aren't readily apparent. Matt?
I think, John, everybody's sort of right on it. But I think that there's something in aversion there, that the apathetic reaction and even a detached reaction or a detached attitude, there's something to look at in aversion. What am I averse to? Is it, I don't want to listen to this person, or I don't want to hear what this person has to say, or I don't want to commit to this particular action, or whatever it is. There's something in that dynamic of desire and aversion, or clinging and avert.
Yeah. Yeah, aversion is just another form of greed or craving or desire. It's the desire, the craving, for something to be different than it is. I've created an aversion to something because I want something different than what's occurring. A non-clinging mind would simply be present with it. And the reason why that becomes such a meaningful way to live is then we are no longer affected by what's occurring, but we're also mindfully engaged in life as life occurs. There's no apathy in the non-clinging. In fact, it's really just the opposite. If we want to, I mean, that's why I say this all the time, the most loving thing I can do for myself and for all humanity is to take to the Dhamma and awaken, gain full human maturity. Because then I can be fully present in all of life without my own self-referential view saying, I don't like this, but I really like that, creating attachment that way. This sutta concludes with the Buddha saying, once you develop this path, you are free of the three defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. That's really the point. And then there's no distinction between non-clinging and am I apathetic or detached. There's no disturbance. You're empty of that disturbance. Again, what a great question. So thank you. Frank, good to see you tonight.
Good to see everybody. My practice is good. I have a chaotic life, so I have to set my alarm to get up to the commitment to meditate, to sit every morning. I get up at 4:45 a.m., and that puts me out the door at like 6:15, and I spend that time reading, meditating, and but the practice has allowed me to really identify and connect with my breath during the day when I'm off the cushion. When I'm in and around other people, my day is constantly changing. So I pay particular attention, and I'm aware of when cravings or desires come up, and I cling to nothing. I realize that I've been through it before, and when I chase pleasure or chase happiness or whatever, that I don't have to do anything for that stuff. Happiness is just here and now, in my breath. Because my suffering starts when I'm either living in my breath that I took an hour ago or the breath that haven't came yet.
Yeah.
And so that's a good insight for me to keep me staying present. So that doing that allows me not to cling to anything.
Yeah, that's remarkable though, isn't it?
Cling to
breathe. Yeah, well, that's a good thing to cling to. I don't mean to put you on a spot, and if you don't want to answer it, just say next. When you first started your Dhamma practice, a year and a half or so ago, is that right? Wow. Less than a year ago. And even if I could describe the quality of your mind that you have right now, would it have any meaning to you?
If you could describe my mind?
Yes.
How could you do that?
Well, that's kind of my point. But you thoroughly understand it because you've developed it yourself. You've experienced it. Ehepasiko, the Buddha. It's why the Buddha consistently said, use that word. Come and see for yourself. Oftentimes that's used as an excuse to create any type of Dhamma you want. Well, the Buddha said we should just... He knew that if you would develop this simple Dhamma and experience it yourself, you would have something within you that is indescribable. Even a Buddha couldn't describe it to you, but you've experienced it and now it's yours. That's how the Dhamma is developed and in a pretty short amount of time too. So thank you. And excuse me for putting you on the spot. Larry, how are you tonight? It's good to see you.
Great. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Practice is going well. Getting at least 5 minutes in at a time now.
Good for you.
We can get on a little bit longer, but something's better than nothing.
Yeah. And continue to be gentle with yourself, Larry. Short increments are much better than trying to, say, well, I've been meditating 5 minutes, now I'm going to do an hour. Keep doing what you're doing and keep coming to Sangha. You'll develop the Dhamma. Good. Glad you're here. Lorna, how are you tonight? Good to see you.
And I was thinking about the night and the day. You could apply that to weather as well, really. Sure. Yeah, that you know, I don't like it raining, but I like the sunshine. And you have aversion to one and to the other. And so yeah, unsettled in your mind if it's raining when you don't like it raining, etc.
Yeah.
That's it, really. Just doing okay.
Great. Thank you. What you're describing can be a challenge at times. As we start developing a mind of equanimity, that's how it feels. You know, everything is just kind of going along. But the bits of a self-referential ego says, wait a minute, this is really boring. I don't want to live like this anymore. And we just remember, that's an aspect of continued eye-making, part of anatta, part of those three marks. Recognize it. Come back to your Dhamma practice.
I was running on the treadmill, and I run on the treadmill to warm up before I do the exercise with me, strength training exercise, and I was running. And sometimes your mind is thinking, oh God, I can't do it today, I'm too... And your mind is sort of conflicted about your exercises, but you should be doing it, and all that sort of stuff. And my mind was doing, can I do it, you know, do I want to do it? And then I realized, at the same time, I was smiling. And I was, I don't know what that really means. I was kind of taken aback at my own expression at the time. But my mind was in a kind of sort of negative. But I was smiling and happy.
So you were at peace with a less than peaceful mind state.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's the first time, and that phrase actually came to my mind. And I thought, oh, I wonder if this is it. You know, be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state.
That's it.
And that's the first time I've actually recalled a moment that I can say yes, I've experienced that.
Yeah. And that's because of deepening concentration that you're able to even recognize that. I mean, that's all part of the Dhamma practice, so good for you. Diane, how are you tonight? Good to see you.
I'm fine. thank you for the class, and thank you for being here, your steadfastness in this. I sometimes wonder if and, well, in meditation, stuff still comes up. And I keep hoping that someday it'll stop. But then probably I might be dead. So I'll put up with it. But what I was thinking when I came out the door, how can someone my age still feel like a 12-year-old some days? And I thought, okay, but it's this, I was smiling too, peaceful in a less than peaceful mind state. This has been this 12-year-old thing that I was 23, the thing that came up, has been kind of hovering for 3 or 4 days. And I really, you know, just want to do kind of like a macho thing to say, get out of there. But I've been meditating long enough that when I try to kick something out or resist it or throw, you know, ignore it and push it aside, it kind of comes back more intensely. And And I still meditate. There were the other day, I had another meditation thing where I just said out loud, I just do not want to do this. And I sat down and did it anyway.
The best time to meditate.
Yeah. But the thing that's cool about these mind states that come up, that I can go ahead and function and concentrate in other areas, but I know it's like the, you know, a devil on your shoulder or something like that. I know now that it will pass, and all of the emotions that I'm feeling around this incident that happened when I was 23 lessen and eventually dissipate and go away. And it's just like, what is it? Maybe it's kind of like going to the dentist, you know, and you have a cavity and they drill, and if you're, you have a toothache, and you know that when you leave the dentist, usually after the anesthetic wears off and everything, you feel better. So that's kind of how I go through some of these things. I know this will pass. And it's I think the cool part is watching, I don't know how to say this. The ego importance, the ego emotions attached to it, leaving. That's like, what, getting an ice cream cone after you go to the dentist or something like that. I don't know, but it's just, and knowing that that's the process keeps me going with it. It's just something I can't, even, you know, even though sometimes I say, I just don't want to do this today, I just don't ever want to meditate again, ever, I'm done. I just keep doing it. It's what's funny is, that's ego. That's when I smile, when I can, as the observer, I can say, ah, there you are, ego. You're not hiding today, are you? You know, you're right there in my face. So I'm just really grateful for the practice, the teachings. That intention thing of the Eightfold Path helps me an awful lot to bring my focus back to what I am, not the I kind of a thing, but the meta of, I guess, that I, the loving kindness.
The whole Dhamma really revolves around the intention to develop it, right intention. And that, when you think about the simplest thing for any of us to do, should be to just sit quietly for a few minutes and think about your breath. But when we first start doing it, we have such resistance to just doing that, don't we? Mm-hmm. And why? Because that anatta, that self-referential ego self, doesn't want to let go. You know, it's boring. And if we're bored, it's because there's not enough sensory stimulation going on now.
I don't think it's boring.
Well, it's often described it like that with first-time meditators, and people have been meditating for a long time. You know, it's one of the challenges. So glad you're here. Bonnie, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you and everybody. I'm good. Lots of opportunity this week in the past growing days, chance to practice, to try to detach from what's going on around me. And I guess it's good. Okay. You know, I have an opportunity to apply the Eightfold Path to the things that have been coming up.
Yeah, good.
So it's, and, you know, it's also cyclical, or is there a word? One goes into the other, and to the other, and to the other, and leads back always for me to the Eightfold Path, and how to me, it really does lead to all things and how I want to be mindful in the world, and how it all is also provocative when it sets up the challenge to that I have a choice.
Oh yeah.
About what to do with the thought or feelings that come up to interfere with that.
Yes, and you have a framework in which to make that choice now.
Yeah.
Rather than it being the choice being motivated from conditioned thinking, you have much more, as the Buddha said, you have knowledge and vision, true vision, to see things more clearly and make wiser choices.
It's like a ladder almost to me, you know.
Yeah, we simply live better in the world. That's what the Buddha taught, a practice for human beings to develop full human maturity, so that we can live a life of lasting peace and happiness. That was his only concern. Of course, it's the answer to everything, isn't it? A life of lasting peace and happiness.
Well, because it's so brilliant. I know I've said this before. It's just like, it blows my mind a little bit that it's like, as old, that, you know, yeah, it's like 2,600 years old.
It was a while ago.
But that each aspect of it is so significant always.
Mm-hmm.
So valuable.
Yeah, that's why they're described as noble truths, meaning a noble family is a family that usually maintains their power for a longer period of time than, say, a senator or a president. They're noble truths. They're just as true today as they were 2,600 years ago. And they will continue to be true. They'll continue to be useful teachings because of that. They describe the common human condition of conditioned thinking. Exactly, and they give a pure, direct, and accessible path to end that, to end our own contribution through right intention. So, great class. Any other questions or comments on tonight's teachings? So we'll finish with metta. A few announcements. What's the first one? I'm teaching in Clinton now on Thursday nights as opposed to Lambertville. I'm up at the 100 and Wellness Center at 7 o'clock. The next Donna dinner, that's a while, is November the 22nd, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. There's a flyer out there. This will be our seventh Donna dinner. Donna means generosity, and we've been having them at Love and Oven, and it's a free community dinner. It really is an amazing event. Please come and feel free to bring your children. There'll be a lot of kids there. There's info on the website too, I'll tell you about that in a little bit. November 22nd is the Donna dinner. The December 4th is our next one-day retreat. Right here begins at 10, ends around 3 o'clock. There's info on the website about that. And Matt is going to lead us in some very restful exercises, too. So that's going to be great. The following week, beginning on December 6th, we're going to start the next Truth of Happiness course like we did last winter over the holidays and into February. So the same class will be given on Tuesdays and on Saturdays of that same week. That way, if you miss one, you can make it up on the Saturday. I think that's it. Any other announcements? That's it. So let's finish with metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture. And again, gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths and take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or the future, or that may have arisen from our talk today. And we'll finish with the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Buddha's words on metta. So the Karaniya Metta Sutta shows that the most loving and compassionate action that anyone can take is to engage wholeheartedly with the direct teachings of the Buddha and awaken. The Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small,
the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.